So it's been a while since we've studied Sefer Shoftim, and so it's important for us to kind of recap a little bit. We're in the middle of Perek Tet Zayin, chapter 16, officially up to Pesach Chaf Aleph. And what really is, it's in a way, it's a standalone story, the last 11, 12 psukim in the Perek, which is where we're going to concentrate first. It's the end of the Shimshon narrative, the end of the Shimshon story, which is a story that really had ups and downs. And it is kind of symbolic of, maybe you would even say, the time period of the Yimei HaShoftim. In truth, you probably say that's Jewish history, Bechlal. And the, you know, it's kind of hard to find a Sefer in Tanakh that's only full of the up. And maybe that, you know, that's a little bit of way of us to get chizuk, because we also don't live with just ups. We live with downs as a nation, as individuals. And the end of the Shimshon story is rather, it's tragic, with a little bit of a sense of comfort to Shimshon, and then, you know, kind of maybe even bigger picture. And what happened was is that the beginning of Perek Tet Zayin that we had done, the first 20 or so psukim, led to Shimshon finally being captured by the Plishtim, because his secret was finally left out, that the Delilah, the woman that he had fallen in love with, had finally gotten through to him, he had finally told her how the strength, his superhuman strength, is tied to the fact that he was a specific type of Nazir. Again, we spoke about the type of Nazirus which focused on the prohibition of not cutting the hair, and that if you cut his hair, it would sap his strength. And the final psukim we read was that actually happening. Interestingly enough, she did not choose to be the one who cuts off the hair. She has someone else do it for her. And the last pasuk that we read together was pasuk chaf. We'll go back to it. Vatomer plishtim alecha Shimshon. She said to him, right? He was in the middle of sleeping. She said to Shimshon, the plishtim are upon you. Which she had said that previously. Meaning previously we had seen the exact language where he had kind of told her some fake type of story of what gives him the strength, and she tested him to see if he was right, saying the plishtim are upon you, and immediately he would wake up and the super strength would be there. So here it happens, and even though we were told that his strength had been taken away, it's going to be clear from the pasuk that he was not aware of it. So he hears the alarm that the plishtim are nearby. Vayikatz mishna, so he wakes up from his sleep. Vayomer, and he says, Eitze kepam bepam v'ina er. I will go out kepam bepam, like the time, like this time, like that time. Meaning, I'm going to go out like every other time that I've ever gone. V'ina er is a language of almost like uru, right? We're in the tshuva season of uru yishenim, of waking up, is almost saying that he needs to like get himself going in order to fight. V'hulo yada, but the pasuk says v'hulo yada ki Hashem sar me'alav, that Hashem had departed from him. And in truth, we see there from, again, this is our, right? This is Shmuel Hanavi writing the story, but from the religious perspective, Shimson's superhuman strength was never something unique to his actual muscles and unique to his strength. It came through some unique presence of Hashem, and that if Hashem is sar me'alav, if Hashem is removed from him, so there goes the superhuman strength. He's unaware of it, and so immediately pasachaf aleph vayochazuhu plishtim. They're able to take hold of him. They're able to seize him, to grab him. What's interesting is immediately they do something finite in terms of a punishment, in terms of a physical deforming of Shimshon. Vayinakar es einav, they gouged out both of his eyes. Vayuridu oso azasa, they brought him down to Aza, which was one of the five main Plishti cities. Vayasru banuchushtayim, and they put bound him in chains. Vayhi tochein bevesa asurim, and he would grind. We'll see what that maybe refers to, but grind, most likely grind wheat in the prison. I say it's interesting that they gave him a physical punishment right away. It's almost as if you would explain that the Plishtim didn't believe that Shimshon was down for the count. The Plishtim you know, understood based on what they've been told that he had at least what they considered to be a moment of weakness, and that if he had a moment of weakness, it was their opportunity. But if you knew what we knew, that Shimshon presumably is never going to regain his strength, right? As the trajectory now is that he'll never regain his strength. Why do you have to punish him so? So a few ideas come forward. Number one is they maybe didn't believe that. And number two, something that we'll kind of see hints to in some of their words in their celebration, is that Shimshon, maybe one of the first characters in Tanakh this way, Shimshon was larger than life. There was the actions that Shimshon actually did, and then there was the thought of what he could do, or maybe the rumors of what he did, and that we'll see the way people talk about him, even the way we'll hear at the end of the parak where he does something, you know, monumental. It basically says that what he had done previously failed in comparison to his final act of glory. And that it seems that when you boil it down, he didn't do so much significant damage against the Plishtim, but it was more like the messaging that came forward, the PR, that he maybe even didn't know, that the Plishtim felt fearful, so they immediately, by Inakrias Enov, they have to gouge out his eyes. So, is anything significant about the eyes? So, we have in Sefer Shmuel an episode where Shaul HaMelech is tested for the first time, and there's this foreign king who, at least the way the Nabi calls him, his name is Nachash, which obviously it's a little bit strange because what are the chances his parents called him Nachash? But it's more like the Tanakh sometimes has this, when you are a Nachash, the Tanakh will sometimes describe you as a snake. And so he comes and he surrounds a certain town, and he threatens them. I'm giving you a week, and if you don't submit to me in a week, I'm going to poke out one of your eyes. The whole town. The way the Mefarshim understand it there, it's a sign of disgrace. It's a sign of disgrace, and therefore, I think we could adopt that here, that they were trying, now why they feel the need to do both of his eyes. So I think that may speak to the fact that they recognize that he was an adversary, that they respected his strength. And, you know, if this is truly a momentary lapse from their perspective and his strength, well, if they knock out both of his eyes, no matter how strong he is, you know, he's not going to be able to be the Shimshon he was. Chazal, in their infinite wisdom, they see significance, particularly that the punishment comes to his eyes, because each time that Shimshon was kind of enticed, it was a veloso sur achare levavchem v'achare nechem. It was that he strayed after his eyes, in terms of being attracted to women, the Plishti women. And again, Shimshon becomes one of these really complex figures in Tanakh. He is a shofet. He is righteous. He's given this gift that almost no one else has been given in history by Hashem. And so there's so much positive. There's so much, right? We still, as far as I know, we still name people Shimshon. We still, it's not like a Masorah not to name someone Shimshon because of his, it was an up and down. And here, his downfall particularly came through his eyes. So presumably you would say some of his tshuva process had to, right, lo aleinu, anyone should ever go through that. But in the kind of the macro picture, someone like Shimshon, and there's even going to be a hint to this in a Rashi, but it was based on a Chazal, that someone like Shimshon would much rather be punished in this world than be punished in the next world. And if his sin in this world was tied, was kashur and tied to his eyes, so his punishment had to be that way. And again, we can't understand the ways of Hashem, but somehow this was what he needed for his kapara. They take him to Aza. Why Aza over any of the other prominent Plishti cities? Not necessarily anything in unique about Aza at that time. You know, there were five. We hear it. There were five main Plishti cities. Aza was just one of them. Right? That technique. You know, whether ancient Aza is the same as Gaza City today, I don't know for sure. First of all, you're probably not going to any tours of that area right now, but the name, right, the ayin is a guttural sound. The ayin is more of a gut and more of an ayin. It's hard for Americans to say it, but Gaza and Aza are the same place. So it's there in the lands of the Plishtim.
Not English, it's Gaza. Does your English say Gaza?
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, that's the normal way to translate. That's the normal, you know, secular way to translate Aza as Gaza. They put him into chains, again, signifying the fact that he needs to be bound up. That they don't know that what they have is a wounded soldier. That they probably don't have to be so severe in terms of their treatment of him. But you know, because now he's blind and he's in chains. What is he possibly going to do? But it speaks to the threat that they felt from him and the adversary that they saw. Vahitochein v'beis asurim, that he was grinding in prison. So the Mitzudas David explains that it was some type of hand mill, which is a heavy malacha. It's very hard, and it's also disgraceful to sit there and just grind by hand all day long. It's a disgraceful activity. The Radak quotes two explanations. One is extremely practical, and he says it goes beyond the beyond Eretz Plishtim at the time. He calls it, he says, Nira Minaga Artzos, to try to basically get labor out of prisoners. Meaning, how do you, something that I don't think about, how do we pay for our prisons? Well, if you could get the prison to pay for itself, it's self-sufficient. So if you have the prisoners work, and again, different societies take this maybe in different ways. There are, you know, definitely, I think, during World War II, there were efforts that prisoners should be part of the war effort. There are different abilities to kind of make use of that labor. But in this era, they would make use, just not as a punishment, but almost to keep the prison going. They would have them working a mill, whether it was a mill with their hands, a mill with stones, however they milled grain. The second approach that the Radak quotes comes out of the Gemara, which the Radak writes the phrase to introduce it, v'derech hadrash rachok bazeh. And the kind of the additional level interpretation is way distant than this. And the Gemara says something which most of the Mefarshim, or if not all the Mefarshim, don't want to understand at the, you know, simple explanation of the Gemara level, and they provide, will provide at least one approach. The Gemara Masecha Sota says that tochen, grinding, is used in Iyov as a euphemism for relations between a man and a woman. And the Gemara says that what they did was, each of the Plishtim brought their wives, and what, again, if you're reading the Gemara literally, it sounds like they brought their wives to be intimate with Shimshon, in order that their children would be, you know, they raise a level, a generation of Giborim. All the Mefarshim are bothered by that, because how could, right, this is supposed to be Shimshon in his tshuva mode. Now clearly this maybe would have been out of his control, but if this is Hashem guiding him towards his, you know, his kapara, why Hashem wouldn't put him in such a position? The Al-Shech HaKadosh is one who explains that we shouldn't understand that Gemara literally. We should understand it based on another statement the Gemara makes. The Gemara says that a person is influenced by their thoughts, and that even when a woman is trying to conceive, the thoughts that she has when she conceives will have some bearing on the child. And that there's a separate Gemara which the Al-Shech doesn't reference. There's a famous Gemara about Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan was an Amora, and he was considered to be exceedingly handsome. The Gemara says he would sit near the mikveh, so that when women would leave the mikveh, they would glance upon him. So they would have images of handsomeness, and that would produce handsome children. And he wasn't looking at them, because that would not be appropriate. So he was looking down, they would look upon him, and it was considered like altruistic that he was doing that. And so the way the Al-Shech explains is that the Plishti men brought their wives to at least look at Shimshon. Look at what a gibor looks like, which again, it's futile, because Shimshon's strength was gone and pretty much gone for good outside of one miraculous, you know, occurrence, and that his strength never came from his physical appearance. His strength came from Hashem. And that, you know, it makes sense that they were focused on just the outward instead of the essence of what gave him his strength. And again, I think that's one of the reasons I think the Radak Whether the Radak knew what the Al-Shach said or didn't, I think that's why he says, "Vaderech Hadrash Rachok Mizeh." It seems to be a very far from the way we're explaining Shimshon at this time, and therefore there must be many ways to understand it, not literally, but it's more of a figurative understanding. Pasuk Chaf Beis. Vayachel se'arosho litzameach k'asher gulach. And his hair began to sprout in the place that it had been cut. Parenthetically, when you get a haircut, your hair starts to grow. There's a rabbi I used to teach with, because sometimes boys come into school with haircuts that are not, great for whatever varying reasons. Our principal likes to say that he wants the hair to be achdus, the same level of hair on the top should be on the bottom, everything should be kind of even, whatever that is. That's his, PC language. But another colleague of mine used to say, what's the difference between a good haircut and a bad haircut? 2 weeks. Eventually, whatever, this grows back, so the Navi is saying that his hair grows back, which is just natural. Why that's being told to us is that we're about to see that Shimshon wanted one last time to make use of his strength. Many of us are familiar with the story. And what was the motivation? The motivation, perhaps, kind of an outward motivation, is that perhaps Shimshon thought that if his hair starts to grow back, his strength will come. When that wasn't really the case. It wasn't really the case. It was the fact that he was born a Nazir. He was born under this guide of never allowing the razor to come onto his head. That was almost, you would almost say, was part of the conditions of his coming into existence. The fact that the Malach is telling his mother before he's in this world that this is how he's going to be. So it wasn't that this was actually going to bring back his strength. It's not that this is the comeback story. So now his hair grows back, he's going to break out of the jail and he's going to go back to being the Shofet. But it did at least give him, perhaps you would say, like a little bit of confidence that he could make a one last effort, beseeching Hashem in tefillah, as we'll see, and that the strength ends up coming through the tefillah. The strength ends up coming through Hashem. It's not through the hair. I mean, it never was through the hair. But on a human level, on a Shimshon, just the man level, the fact that his hair was starting to grow back, that gave him a little bit of a boost, that maybe he would regain some of what he had. Pasuk Chaf Gimel. V'sarnei plishtim ne'esvu lizboach zevach gadol l'dagon Eloheihem u'lesimcha. So the officers, the governors of the plishtim, they gathered to make a feast, lizboach zevach, to offer sacrifices, zevach gadol, a great sacrifice, whether that's a great sacrifice in singular or a great sacrifice made, most likely made up of many animal sacrifices, l'dagon Eloheihem, to dagon their god, u'lesimcha, and to rejoice. Dagon was this half fish, half man, kind of like a merman type of god that the Plishtim had, which made good sense because the Plishtim lived on the coast and the Plishtim needed fishing and that industry was how they earned their livelihood. And so always you in the realm of Avodah Zarah, usually you try to worship an Avodah Zarah that makes sense to you, right? You're not gonna live in the desert and worship a water god. You're gonna worship the sun god because you the sun is always on you, so you need like protection from the sun. If you're a water-based society, you're gonna worship a water-based Avodah Zarah, like something that has to do with fish. Vayomer, and they said in their rejoicing, Nasan Eloheinu Biadenu, our God, lowercase g, has given over into our hands as Shimshon Oyvenu, Shimshon, our enemy. They're celebrating the fact that Shimshon has given over into their hands. Pasuk Chaf Dalet. Vayiru Oso Ha'am. Vayiru Oso Ha'am, the people saw. Because here we're hearing about how this, the previous pasuk was how the governors are celebrating, but now the regular Plishti people, vayihalu es Eloheihem, they praised their God. Ki amru, they said, nasan Eloheinu biadenu es oivenu, So our God has given over into our hands our enemy. So they're initially referring to Shimshon in the same manner that the governors did. But then the Es Machariv Artzenu, the destroyer of our land, Va'asher Hirba Es Chalalenu, and the one who increased, a chalal is a dead body, the one who increased the number of our slain ones. And they speak of Shimshon in the most gory terms, but also in terms of an enemy. This is like, it's like they've taken down the greatest enemy they've ever had. And in truth, when we pattern it after with the things that Shimshon did, Shimshon didn't cause that much actual havoc upon the Plishti. We're talking about the number of lives, the number of damage in the episode that he had with the foxes and burning of the fields. It wasn't that great. But they speak of it in such terms. Marchariv es artzenu, he's the destroyer of our land. And he increased, right? The Pasuk's going to say in his last ditch effort, he's going to end up killing more people than he ever killed before. And they make him out like he's like an army. I think it speaks to the way they felt about Shimshon, that it didn't necessarily match up. And actually part of the significance of the Shimshon story, because if you recall, Shimshon always acted on his own. He never wanted anything to come back. He never wanted to push them to take revenge against the Jewish people for the actions that he did. He wanted it to be only on him. And you could ask, what kind of significance is that going to have? It's not going to be everlasting. It was an idea that for whatever reason, during this time in history, the Plishtim were beginning to make inroads against Klal Yisrael, and Shimshon saw and was blessed by Hashem to at least spend a certain amount of time showing that Klal Yisrael is not going to go down without a fight. That Klal Yisrael is going to, at various points, stand up for themselves. And yes, historically, they're not going to fully engage with and then beat the Plishtim until the time of David, which is decades from where we are now. But Shimshon's mission was almost to stand up for Kavod Yisrael, for stand up for the honor of the Jewish people in this time. And so the fact that he was more successful in terms of like the rumor, the impact that people thought he could make, that may have actually been more important than the actual aspects of damage or killing that he was able to achieve in almost taking revenge for Klal Yisrael. So this is the word on the street. The word on the street. This is the people talking. This is right. The first pasuk is the governor's talking. This is the word on the street. Pasuk of Hey. Vayi ketov libam. It was when their hearts were good. Tov libam, right? So the Metzudas David says it's achila v'shtia. They had eaten, they had drunken. What's coming to mind is, right, ketov lev hamelach b'yayin in Megillas Esther. So there the Megillah actually spells it out. Ketov lev hamelach b'yayin. He asked, right? That's when he asked for Vashti. It was in a moment of, you would say he was being irrational, but he was inebriated. He was ketov lev. So here, we're about to see some of what they were requesting of Shimshon is similar in the regard that it's being made, particularly after they had eaten, after they had drunken. Bayomru, and they said, Kiru l'Shimshon v'yisachik lanu. Call to Shimshon, meaning gather him, invite him here, v'yisachik lanu, he should be sported before us. Vayikru l'Shimshon, they called Shimshon mibesa asurim from the prison. Vayitzachik l'fnehem, and he sported before them. Vayamidu oso bein amudim, and they stood him between the two posts. What were they trying to accomplish? They were trying to accomplish to ridicule Shimshon. They had the Metzudas Tzion says, what does it mean to sport before them? They wanted him to tell stories of his strength. What's the significance of telling stories of his strength? Because if you hear stories of his strength, and now you see him, that he's been sapped of his strength, so that you almost get more of an enjoyment, more of a nachas, a geshmak, out of the fact that they forced him to tell stories of his might, so now they had a greater appreciation for their quote-unquote victory, and he is, being further put on public display of punishment, And you know, from a certain perspective, you'd almost be saying that there's an aspect, the fact that Hashem allowed this to happen, it must be part of his personal kapara, again, to kind of get rid of anything in this world, and they end up standing him between the posts. Pasuk Chavav. Vayomer Shimshon el Hanar, Hamachzik biyado. Shimshon said to a boy, it was a nar, Hamachzik biyado, who was holding his hand, Hanicha osi, let go of me, Vahamisheni el Amudim, and let me touch the actual posts, Asher habayis nachon alehem, that the bayis, that the house is resting upon them, right? Nachon, Mitzvot Tzion defines as nish'an al mechono, to kind of be resting on the foundation, meaning that these were the posts, right, that support, right, in structures today, right, downstairs in the parking garage. We have to be so careful about those concrete posts, but they're good that they're there, right? They hold up the building, they hold up the garage, so they're good that they're there. But the so he wants to rest his hands on them, the esha'in alehim, and I will lean upon them. And obviously he has a plan that most of us are familiar with. Pasuk Chav Zayin, v'habayis male anashim v'nashim. This house or this building, when we see how many in total people were there, so it's clearly not just a bayis. It's some type of large building where they gathered to celebrate this victory against Shimshon and to bring the zevach, to bring the animal sacrifices to their god. It was full of men and full of women. V'shama kol sarnei plishtim, and there were all the governors of the plishtim, which usually, even though I don't think we saw the number here, usually the plishtim, the sarnei, the governors, number five. There were five because there were five main cities. Each city kind of had a governor. V'al ha-gag, and on the roof, which almost makes it sound like there were even more people on the roof, on the second story of the structure, kishloshes alafim ish v'isha, like 3,000 men and women, haroim b'schok Shimshon, who were able to see the sport of Shimshon. Now, how it actually looked, you know, how could it be that people are on the second story and they can see? So perhaps there are balconies. There's some. I can't say I fully picture it. I don't know if anyone's tried to draw this. There's biblical art throughout. Like an amphitheater, yeah, something like that. But it seems that, and again, how structures are built, it seems that the posts that Shimshon is next to, they're the, and maybe that's the phrase that why the Mitzudos Sion says Nishan Amachono, that, and that uses the word Nachon, that some pillars are more important than others in a structure, and that Shimshon was next to the two most crucial pillars for the building to remain up. Pasuk Chavchas. Vayikra Shimshon el Hashem, and Shimshon calls out to Hashem. Vayomar, and he says, well, the way we would read this is right, if you were the way we would pronounce it is Hashem Elokim. Right? When we read Navi, when we have two names of Hashem spelled like that, we would pronounce the first one as Adnas, as Adoshem, and the second one, which if it was alone, we would pronounce it as Adoshem. We pronounce it as Elokim. So he's referencing two names of Hashem, which is significant in calling out to Hashem in this tefillah, to call Hashem both Adnas, which is the master of the world, and almost showing Hashem's mastery over the world. There's the Elokim, which is how we pronounce it, which is usually Hashem's manifestation of his din, of his judgment. But then there's the Yud-Kei, Vav-Kei, which is how it's spelled, which is actually Hashem's name of mercy. And that Shimshon, in referring to Hashem in both ways, Hashem Elokim, or Adnos and Yud-Kei, Vav-Kei, it's almost as if Shimshon was at the same time accepting the din, accepting the judgment that God had meted out against him based on his actions, and yet beseeching Hashem for mercy to allow him one more opportunity. And that the truth is that a person needs to be able to do both. A person has to be able to look towards Hashem as the as the Avinu and the Malkeinu, as the one who is Adnus and the strict din, and then there is Yudke Vavke, which is Rachamim, which is mercy. It plays a role when you look back at the creation story. We have in Bereishis, and initially it's just Elokim, right? The first parak is Vayar Elokim. That's Hashem as din, as being strict judgment. And that, unfortunately, that Hashem saw that couldn't work in a certain sense, that man couldn't handle that. And so in Parak Beis, when we shift the story, then it's Hashem Elokim. It's bringing in the mercy, the Rachamim, from that usually we need more of, and that Shimshon needed in this moment, because the track record of Shimshon is that he's fully on a down, and that if he's reaching out to Hashem, is Hashem going to want to answer him? Is Hashem going to, but if he can acknowledge and almost accept, almost like a tzidduk hadin, right? When someone passes away, we recite the tzidduk hadin, which is accepting Hashem's righteousness. It's making the bracha of Dayan HaEmes, that if you can make the bracha of Dayan HaEmes, so then you can, right? So normally we make the bracha of Dayan HaEmes because just like, you know, whatever happens, we have to believe that Hashem happens for a reason. But the one who is like Shimshon, who's almost, in a certain sense, he's on the outs from Hashem in terms of his relationship. After he makes the Dayan HaEmes, so then he can rebuild the relationship. He can ask for something, and therefore you kind of there's because when we ask, to a certain extent, when you ask for something, you're asking for a withdrawal, right? You're asking for a withdrawal from your spiritual bank with Hashem. Obviously, it's unlimited. Right? Hashem doesn't say, "I'm only going to give you this." But the relationship is reciprocal. You have to give something towards Hashem. So when he says Adoshem, that's Shimshon giving towards Hashem. When he says Yudke Vavke, it's the Rachamim, it's the asking. And he says Zachrenina, remember now, please. V'chazkenina, give me strength now. Achapam Hazelokim, this one time. The inachma nikma nikam achas mishte enai miflishtim. Give me strength this one time, which already acknowledges that Shimshon, he wasn't asking. He knew he couldn't be brought back to his position of prominence. He knew he couldn't go back to being a shofet. He was accepting that. He was asking for one last time of strength, one last moment of strength, and allow me to take revenge. For one, right, it's a little bit of a strange language. Nikma, nikam, achas, mishte enai. For one of my two eyes from the plishtim. Why one of his two eyes? So Rashi quotes from Chazal, he only wants one eye to get revenge in this world because he wants the pain and the suffering from his other eye to be his ticket into Olam Haba. That he wants it to be that he is earned his Olam Haba, and not that any in any way, shape, or form, you know, he gets this revenge now, and that's going to count as the good that's coming towards him. So that's the way that Rashi explains the fact that he's only asking for one of his two eyes.
So he's accepting that the punishment, one eye, you know, that was a punishment. I get it. Second
eye,
that was a
push of
going too far.
Okay, yeah. So that we could say a beautiful thought that meaning it, him asking Hashem to give me revenge for one of his eyes is a continuation of Shimshon being mekabel his state, and that he was deserving of punishment. He got his punishment, but perhaps the punishment went too far. And in truth, that's usually what happens, right? Because when you ask the question, right, why were the Babylonians punished for destroying the first Beis Hamikdash? Hashem clearly was the one who decided that the first Beis Hamikdash should be destroyed. The fact that the Babylonians stepped up to the plate and destroyed it, in and of itself, is not the reason why they get punished. Meaning, they were chosen as a shliach of Hashem. It's when the enemy of Israel takes it too far. It's when, right, the Babylonians had to destroy the Beis Hamikdash. They didn't have to necessarily kill the amount of people that they killed, right? Nebuzadran, who was his name was Rav HaTabachim, the chief executioner. That's the title that he's given by Tanakh, and we talk about it in the Kinos, so the Gemara talks about the stories about him. you don't get the title chief executioner because you brought down a building. You get it because you were merciless. You didn't have any mercy, and you took it too far. So then the nations of the world can get punished when you overstep your bound. They, honestly, it goes back even to Mitzrayim. What did Mitzrayim do wrong? Right, Hashem told Avraham Avinu, your children have to be, you know, strangers in a strange land, and they have to be, maybe even they have to be slaves. They have to be slaves. They don't have to, it doesn't have to be avodah kasha, right? It didn't have to be bitter enslavement. It could have been whatever, fill in the blank, indentured slave, some type of dignified slave. You know, it's hard to use that word, dignified slavery, but it could have been, you know, it could have been labor without backbreaking labor. It could have been, you know, build cities. Don't build Pisom and Ramses, which were, you know, Chazal tell us would just fall, and it was more about the mindset of they give the Chazal. There's the Medrash of the, I'm pretty sure it's with Mitzrayim, of the individual who's always pushing a mill, but he can't see what's on the other side of the wall, and he's always thinking in his mind that he is contributing to society by pushing this mill. And then one day, maybe it's a prisoner, I don't remember exactly, and one day they let him see that on the other side of the wall is nothing. And then he loses his mind. Because he realized, because there's something to your work that there's significance. The work in Mitzrayim ended up being baseless. It went nowhere. And so that's why the Mitzrayim got punished. So maybe there's an aspect of the Plishtim here. Because again, the Plishtim right now are going to get punished. Right now there's about to be a huge punishment coming their way. And maybe you say it's because they took it too far. They took it too far with Shimshon, and that maybe that's symbolic of the two eyes. He's saying, allow me revenge for one of the eyes, because that would have been, again, in a way that we can never understand punishment, but Shimshon is maybe even saying that would have made sense. One, I went eye straight after my eyes, that needed to happen. But two, that's taking it too far, and so he asks only for. It's a horrible set of psukim, but it's a significant and meaningful thought. Pasuk Chavtas. Vayilfos Shimshon es shnei amudei hatavach. Vayilfos is an interesting, not common word. Mitzidus Sion says inyan achiza. He ends up quoting from Rus. This is not a common term, but it means he grabbed hold of the Shnei Amudei HaTavach, the two posts that were... HaTavach means, the Mitzvah Tzion says, the middle ones. Asher Habayis Nachon Aleihem, that this structure was kind of leaned on or centered on, founded on, but Yismoch Aleihem, he leaned against these posts, Echad b'minyo ve'echad b'smolo. One with his right hand and one with his left hand. Pasuk Lamed. Vayomer Shimshon. And Shimshon says, Tamus nafshi im plishtim. My nefesh, my soul should die with the plishtim. Vayet b'koach. And he leaned with strength. Vayipol habayis al hasaranim, and he caused the entire structure to fall upon the governors, v'al kol ha'am, and upon all the people, asher bohu, that were there. And the pasuk then testifies, vayu amesim asher hemis b'moso, rabim me asher hemis b'chayav. There were among the dead of this episode more that Shimshon caused with his own death, more so than any that he had killed in his lifetime. And that, you know, kind of echoes us back to the thought that when we sit there and look at the actual things that he did, and then the way that we spoke about today, how the people spoke about him. So here, we're not given an exact number. Was it that every single person involved here was killed? We're not sure. But we know that it was a much greater number than anything he had done before. Including himself. There is, the elephant in the room type of question is, how could Shimshon do this? How could Shimshon take his own life, even if it meant, getting revenge from the Plishtim, and whether that revenge is just for him, whether there's still an element of of almost, you know, you almost say that Shimshon, even in his death, he's being true to his mission to stand up for Kavod Yisrael, that he's another small victory against the Plishtim, who are, to whatever degree they are, subjugating the Jews in Eretz Yisrael at this time. And so there's, but what gives him the right to give up his life to do that? And, you know, kind of the approach that kind of is the most sound is that we never hear an actual verbal acceptance of his tefillah to Hashem. Right? He gives off a tefillah. Shimshon at this point is not in any state that is fit to receive prophecy. He doesn't receive nevuah. It's not like Hashem says, I'm with you. But all of us would agree, and anyone reading this would agree, that for Shimshon to be able to accomplish what he accomplished, it had to be b'siyata d'shmaya. It had to be with help from heaven. It had to be, you'd put it in the category of miracle, that the blind man who was sapped of his super strength is going to regain that strength momentarily and is going to be able to take two pillars and knock down an entire structure and cause this huge collapse that not only kills himself, kills all these officials and kills others along with it. The greatest event that he's going to kill more people when he's weak than when he's strong. It doesn't make any sense without seeing the merit, without seeing it through the lens of a nes, through the lens of a miracle, which is the answer of the tefillah. The tefillah was, Hashem, give me strength one more time. And it happened. The fact that Hashem answered him. So Shimshon was basically saying, Hashem, if you will this occurrence to happen, and me as your vehicle, well then it's really, I'm not belittling the fact that Shimshon still had to be the one to do it. But it's almost as if Shimshon was saying, Hashem, this is not an act of me taking my own life. This is me being a shliach, carrying out your will. And if carrying out your will is doing this, because first and foremost, once you're going with the miracle card, so if Hashem wanted to, the miracle card could have gone further, that Shimshon would have been alive. And he wasn't. So that it's not Shimshon, at least in the way that the Mefarshim view it, it's not Shimshon taking his own life, but it's Shimshon acting fully as a shliach of Hashem. And it was God's decision that he did not survive this. One might also say that in terms of another sign that this was quote unquote the right thing to do, or that Shimshon is not held responsible for taking his own life, is the way that the parak concludes. Vayer in Pasuk Lamed Aleph, Vayer du Echav v'chol beis avihu. All of his sons, his brothers, Vayerdu Echav, his brothers come down, V'chol Beis Avihu, and in his father's whole household, Vayisu Oso, and they carried him, Vaya'alu, they brought him up, Vayikberu Oso, and they buried him, Bein Tzara'u, Bein Eshta'ol, Bekever Manoach Aviv, they buried him between Tzara'u and Eshta'ol, in the burial place of his father, Kivrei Avos. And then we hear kind of as a closing phrase, V'hu shafat es Yisrael eshrim shana, he judged the people for 20 years. The fact that he was given Kvuras Yisrael in an extremely dignified way is another sign of Hashem's acceptance of his tefillah, and you might say acceptance of his tshuva. The fact that he, right, everything, right, when he's taken into prison and when his eyes are gouged out, at that moment, we think it's over. We think, you know, we can't even imagine the horrific life and then post-life that he would have in terms of disgracing his body and not being able to be buried and anything like that. The fact that he's given kvura is another indicator that Hashem was along with Shimshon in this, you know, heroic act. And again, that it's considered to be divine what took place. The two approaches to looking at his ability to be buried is twofold. Either the Plishtim allowed for this to happen in some level of like, it sounds strange to say it, but like out of respect for Shimshon, their enemy. Meaning, if you really have respect for your enemy, you know, he got them, even when they thought he couldn't get them, he got them anyway. And it's almost as if he outsmarted them. Blind, weak, he outsmarted them. And so almost out of a respect, they still allow him to be buried by his people. And you know, just because you are an enemy doesn't mean you doesn't mean you have to disrespect your enemy. Even though we have occurrences even among, you know, so maybe some of you are going to appreciate the second shot, because the Plishtim, unfortunately, within the Tanakh, they don't have a track record of actually doing that, because the Plishtim held on to when Shaul is killed / causes his own death in a war against the Plishtim took his body and didn't treat it with respect. And so there's, you know, so the second approach, which maybe you'd appreciate more, is that it was in the moments after in the aftermath of this crisis of the building falling down, of there being many dead, probably the last thing that the Plishtim were worried about is Shimshon's body. And so in kind of that moment of Hefkeris, of everything being, his family members were able to come and take his body and bring him to Kvura, and that, you know, had they know about it, okay, so, you know, they knew. Maybe it is part of the miracle that Hashem helped them to know, so that they'd be able to come at the right time to make sure he's buried properly. And then the parak ends, V'hu shafat es Yisrael esrim shana. So we were already told that. At the very end of Perek Tesvav, we were told, Vayishpot es Yisrael bimei Plishtim esrim shana. He judged Israel during the days of the Plishtim for 20 years. So we already heard of Shimshon being the shofate for 20 years. So is it that we're just echoing that again? And the question that we raised when we brought this up in Perek Tesvav is, why are we being told about it in Perek Tesvav? We have, you know, we're almost at the tail end of the Sefer. In terms of being introduced to a shofate, he may actually be the last one that we're introduced to in that classical sense. And usually, when you finish the shofate, you give a capstone, you know. And by the way, he judged everyone for this amount of time. And we had the whole debate, does that include the time that they were under the control of the foreign enemy? Does it not? So there was one approach which understood that the 20-year period, there was only one 20-year period. And the 20-year period, the reason really we should be hearing about it at the end of his life, like we always do. The reason why we hear about it in Perek Tesvav is because those were the last moments of Shimshon being purely following in the ways of Hashem and not having any kind of downfalls of his own. And so it's almost like you want to go out on a high note, that at least we talk about his leadership was going, and that everything here is after. There is another approach that is actually two 20-year periods of time. And it speaks to something that we mentioned a few times today. There was the 20-year period of time that Shimshon actively led, and there was 20 years after Shimshon was no longer alive, where still the memory of Shimshon being from the Jewish people, it made an impact upon the Plishtim. That whether they're thinking that there could be another Shimshon, or whether it's just the memories of Shimshon, and maybe you could even make the argument that that's launched off by this final story, right? If we see how they took the small actions of Shimshon and magnified that so that they describe him as the destroyer of the land and the one who killed so many. So how do you think the average Plishti person took this story and probably magnified it in terms of what the potential of the Jewish... Now, it doesn't last forever. So we know the Plishtim come back, and the Plishtim are extremely forceful against the Jews in Eretz Yisrael during the time of Shmuel, and then during the time of David, it's constant until victory is theirs, but until Klal Yisrael is finally fully victorious. But there was an impact that went beyond the Shimshon's time, and maybe that's why we hear another pasuk of 20 years. So you have the 20 years of active leadership with the 20 years of more, you would say, behind the scenes, totally behind the scenes type of leadership. Perek Yud Zayin, chapter 17, which is our next perek, So it involves, the final few chapters of Sefer Shoftim involve two stories. One is called Pesel Micha, the idol of Micha. One is called Pilegesh B'Giva, the concubine of Giva. And there are two horrific stories, two stories that are not, there's no happy ending, unfortunately. It's and the Sefer does not close in a happy way. And the debate is when exactly these stories took place. The way that Shmuel HaNavi chose to present the stories is clear. It's Perek Yud Zayin through the end of the Sefer. And it's very hard to make an argument other than he saw it fit that these two stories are the introduction to Sefer Shmuel. That these two stories are the introduction to the Shofet / Navi, who's Shmuel, who will crown two kings. We're going to see four or five times, you can keep track for extra credit, four or five times throughout these prakim, where we see the announcement that this is all taking place during a time that there was no king. Now, in truth, the entire period of the Shoftim, there was no king. If you want to, maybe we can understand that to a certain degree, Moshe Rabbeinu had the status of a melech in terms of being that real powerful ruler. Maybe to some degree, Yehoshua who takes over. But once we get into the time of the Shoftim, we've been talking about, we don't fully know what a Shofet is. A Shofet, is he or she political? Is it religious? Is it a little bit of both? It seems to be it is, and it's not the all power that a king has. And the ability for a king to rein in the troops, the ability for the king, both on a religious level and a not religious level, it's a practical, getting everyone to get along. The two stories kind of speak to the religious state of the people. It speaks to their interpersonal relationships with one another. And whether or not the stories happened here, Shmuel wants us to have it in our minds before Sefer Shmuel and at the end. It seems that the majority understand that the stories happened earlier, and that we're not told about them, perhaps in order to, like I just said, to prepare us for Sefer Shmuel. But it also there also may be a component of these stories would take away a little bit from the overwhelming majority of the period. The overwhelming majority of the period of the Shoftim were a lot of those decades in between where everything was fine, right? We read, the only news is bad news. Something people don't want to learn, see the newspaper because everything's just bad. So a little bit that's what happens in Sefer Shoftim. We don't hear about the good years when there was 80 years of peace and tranquility. It happened to like twice in a row. What's going on there? So that these stories could end up. To a certain extent, you would think that it was all like that. It was all quote unquote bad, and so we have it here towards the end, so that we have a kind of an appreciation for the positive aspects of the time of the Shoftim, with a reality of the negative aspect of not having a united front of all 12 tribes together under one leader, and that. So the first story will be Pesel Micha, which is over the course of Yud Zayin and Yud Ches, and then it shifts. It shifts to the story of Pilegesh Be'Giva. So Bez Hashem, next time we will begin with Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Aleph.